We'll call Senate House to order. It is about 2:02 and a half on the 29th. Present, we have Senators Olson, Elton, and myself, Chair Dyson. It's our purpose today to hear a report from Fish and Game and the Health Department about what exposure we have in our state to avian flu and what the preparations that are ongoing to monitor the progress and preclude human spread of the disease. The second thing we'll deal with is some questions committee members have about personal care attendant program. So, Carlene? And we're waiting for a cord that I was told to be here in 150 seconds.
I'll talk slowly. How's that? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon, and I'm actually representing my fellow commissioners that can't be here. As you are aware, I'm sure, the governor, through Administrative Order Number 228, has asked all the state departments to coordinate together to be prepared in the event that we have a pandemic influenza in our state. And because we don't know when a pandemic influenza might occur, or whether or not it might be related to an Asian H5N1 avian influenza, the one that's been so much in the media attention lately, we want to be sure that Alaskans understand the differences between those two kinds of influenza and how they also might be related, so that we're prepared for either one or both of those. To help with that preparation today, we have three state experts that are going to be able to talk to you, all three of whom I'm sure you know. Dr. Richard Monsager, our Director of Public Health, will address the human issues around avian and pandemic influenza. Matt Robus, who's the Director of Wildlife Conservation with Fish and Game, as well as Dr. Bob Gerlach, the State Veterinarian with Department of Environmental Conservation, will address issues with wild birds, with environmental concerns, and also the testing that will be going on in our state during the next few months. And we would prefer, if it's possible, Mr. Chair, to have questions happen at the end of their three presentations so you get sort of the whole picture and then can address your questions. But if you'd prefer another way, we certainly are willing to accommodate. And with that, I'm happy to turn it over to Dr. Monsager. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Richard Monsager, Director of the Division of Public Health. I've been here before. I'm not going to repeat the presentation I did about 6 weeks ago at Senate Health Committee around pandemic flu preparedness. I am going to update a little bit and set the stage for differentiating the human issues from the bird issues and where the connectedness is and why the three of us are here today. The first place I wanted to start is with the website that's up here and talk about where people can find information. And this is a multi-agency website. We started on the human side, and now it's become a multi-agency website that has information that people can find across the broad perspective of issues. So if a person has bird questions, they can go to this website. They can either find it at avianflu.alaska.gov or pandemicflu.alaska.gov, and the bird issues are on this side, the human issues are on this side, and in the center are updates. One of the things that I think is important is for everybody to know is every week it'll be updated on Monday afternoon. I think all the legislators were recently received a fax to tell people what the web address was, and we will update both world and national and state news. This is interesting. Huh? It's a PDF file. Okay.
That's
we'll wait
a picture
a second.
Of you this last week, right?
Say again?
That's a picture of you this last week.
I don't run that well. So well, this will come up in a second. So anyhow, every week we'll update news, and so people can get an update. The other thing that will be there is if there are new reports, if the situation changes across the world, and so on. So for example, here, this talks from World Health Organization, where we are in this whole continuum of disease. And if you can page down just a little bit more, And then the worldwide human caseload is summarized by World Health Organization every week. What's not in here this week is that Egypt now is reporting the first two fatalities out of five cases this week. So by next week, it'll be updated, including Egypt with human cases. And cases in China and Indonesia continue on almost a weekly basis. Can you go back to the homepage there, Jeff? The other thing, as when Matt and Bob talk, they'll talk about, you can find information about subsistence hunting, what are frequently answered asked questions and answers. If you're going to cook poultry or wild birds, where can you find information? All of that is here. You can also find it from individual websites, but it's summarized there. Okay, the question that I talked about when I was here before is, why are we concerned about this? Is a human health perspective. I'm not going to repeat all of that. The virus that is causing the bird die-off, it's mostly a bird disease, but occasionally causes human disease, is a virus that we as humans have no immunity to. It's a new variety of influenza A. None of us as humans have had it before. We have no immunity to this H5N1. And it continues to be a virus that, when it does get transmitted from birds to human, is a very lethal disease with almost 50% mortality that is staying consistent across countries, across healthcare systems.
Senator Huggins, you can sit up here if you want.
Well, thanks, sir.
And what I think all of us had hoped was that this was a disease that was killing people because they were in third world health conditions, but now people in first world health conditions in Eurasia, in Hanoi, and so on, are still dying at the same death rate. It is really a lethal disease when it becomes a human disease. The other reason for concern, of course, as I talked about before, is that previous pandemics have been caused by influenza A viruses. They're about 3 per century, so if history is any guide to the future, and that's always a somewhat risky planning proposition, that we should assume that in this century we will have about 3 pandemics of varying intensity and lethality over the next century. Will this virus be the virus that causes a pandemic? Nobody can answer that question. Is it a legitimate threat? Every scientist that I have read or heard talk views this virus as a very legitimate threat, that if it develops the ability to become human-to-human transmissible, it's a bad disease. So our planning issues on the human side need to assume that we will have a pandemic at some time. We need to take this opportunity to improve our preparations, and that's what's underway. Last year, of course, you all updated the public health law, which was a significant step in the authority side. This year, HB 380 has passed the House and is now in the Senate committees and is what I view as the animal companion to the human public health law, to give the appropriate authorities for animal disease control and update those authorities. So many of the new diseases that I see in the human side are what we call zoonotic diseases. They either come from animals or they're transmitted back and forth from animals to human. And on the public health continuum of protecting our communities, we need both sets of authorities. Well, what work has been updated and what's been going on since? Oh, before I get to what work, can you go to the map, Jeff? Just what's happened over the winter in terms of spread of this virus around the world? Well, I think I showed a previous version of this slide when I was here before. And in October, if we'd showed this slide, 6 months ago, this was confined to Southeast Asia. It moved eastward, kind of paralleling the railroad going eastward into Europe. Now most European countries have had disease in wild birds, a few countries in poultry. Human disease is much more scattered. Azerbaijan, as you can see, got added last week. Egypt will be added this coming week. And these countries here in South Asia are filling in rapidly. Nepal is probably positive. Countries in here are now positive. And of course, Africa is the newest addition as it spreads south of the Sahara. So when you look over here, that's not very far away. And the question is will Alaska see this virus in birds? Well, just a couple more comments about the work on the human preparedness side. The multi-agency coordinating committee that was created in response to the governor's administrative order in January is now functional. That most state agencies, some federal agencies, and some non-governmental organizations are meeting every 2 weeks to drive the planning work and working in communities. The community outreach visits and working with communities are getting launched as of next week, working with communities first up and down the rail belt, and then communities in western Alaska during April, in terms of how communities can improve their preparedness, how will they take care of people when hospitals are overwhelmed if this becomes a human disease, and obviously the bird issues that we'll talk about here in the next few minutes really play into concerns in western Alaska, northern Alaska. There will be, over the next 6 months, many training and exercising activities in communities across Alaska. For example, in Ketchikan, the first alternate care site exercise is going to take place in a few weeks. Our planning assumption is if this becomes a human disease, we will overwhelm our hospital capacity. We won't have enough. We will have to be able to care for less sick people in other places other than hospitals. And how do we make that happen? Where do we find volunteers? How do we train them? How do we keep it safe for them to work to take care of other people? And communities are going to have to be largely self-reliant. If this becomes a human disease, being able to share people between communities will be hard. Last week I talked to the Alaska Power Association, as power industry is a critical infrastructure in our state. And the airport in the evening, one of the people came up to me and said, I had thought about how we would share power operators if somebody was sick, but I hadn't thought about the fact that the airplanes might not be flying and I might not be able to get people between communities to keep the power on. Many of our rural communities, power operators, there's only one or two or maybe three people trained, and power infrastructure is going to be really important. So our essential services, protecting essential workers, how we get medicines, assuming we have a stockpile, how we get them to essential workers, all of that is work that we are working on now. So with that, let's go to the bird issues, and then we can come to questions afterward. Matt?
Thank you, and good afternoon. My name is Matt Robus. I'm the Director of Wildlife Conservation for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And as this bird disease issue has expanded across the world, my division has become ever more involved in the nationwide attempt to get a handle on what's going on. I guess I'd like to emphasize at the outset something that Dr. Monsager said, and that is that at present this is still primarily a disease of birds. It developed in Southeast Asia in domestic poultry, infected a few people there who were in very close proximity with the domestic poultry. It has moved back into wild bird populations and has caused a fair amount of mortality in some wild bird flocks. And as wildlife managers, of course, we're very concerned about it from that standpoint. But in addition to that, the National Homeland Security Department convened a collaborative effort between several different federal departments and included the state of Alaska wildlife managers as part of that group. To plan for the early detection of this virus, this particular strain of H5N1, if it came to the North American continent in wild birds. It should be noted that there are several other viable potential pathways for this disease to get here other than wild birds, and it's not at all sure that wild birds are going to be very effective at bringing it here. But since Alaska is at the intersection of Asian flyways and North American flyways, and since we send migratory birds throughout all four continental U.S. flyways, if we do get it by wild birds, it's a national issue in terms of it being carried elsewhere. We are not starting cold in terms of sampling for this virus in Alaska. It's been sampled for since 1998, although in a smaller way than what we're going to be doing this season. Seeing this outbreak beginning to take a little momentum last year, there was actually a University of Alaska study under which we and other biological agencies who handle wild birds piggybacked sampling for this strain of the virus on top of what we were already doing. Once you have the bird in the hand, it's a fairly simple thing to take the swab and and send it to a lab. Of the several thousand, probably 8,000 or 9,000 samples, and maybe more than that, that were gathered, none have come back positive that have been tested so far. So there's no reason to think that this virus has made it into the state or into the North American continent at this point in time. However, this group of agencies put together under the Homeland Security Task Force put together a national strategic sampling plan for the early detection of the Asian strain of H5N1. And we have stepped that down now to where between we and several federal agencies in the Department of Interior and Department of Agriculture have put together an Alaska sampling plan where we plan to gather about 15,000 samples from wild birds in one way or another during the coming season. And that is being targeted at priority species and priority habitats where the chances would be highest of the disease being carried in. Some forms of birds are more likely to carry it than others. So we have kind of divided the state up based on the type of work we normally do, plus added sampling work that we're planning. On the map behind you, you can see many of the locations where we know we can catch some of these priority species, and we're planning to have teams in those locations to pick up birds. And between we and the Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Geological Survey and the Animal Plant Health and Inspection Service, we now have a web figured out where we're going to be out catching or obtaining samples through five basic strategies. First strategy would be capturing a live bird and doing either a tracheal or a cloacal swab to collect the sample. The second strategy would be to collect hunter-killed birds, and we're going to do this both for subsistence-killed birds as well as the regular fall season that obviously doesn't take place for a while. We would also have teams of people ready to respond to reported mortality and morbidity events so that if we had a group of birds that were sick or dead where there was not an obvious reason for them to be in that state, we would respond and do necropsies and get samples from those birds to see what that meant and if it had anything to do with this disease. We also will be doing some sampling of the environment, both water samples and fecal samples, because that's the way that the disease would be spread between birds and between species using the same water body. And then finally, there's the possibility of putting some sentinel birds out in places where if it were difficult to go capture live birds, we could basically put birds out in a cage and then go back and test them at a later date to see if they'd picked up the disease. So across the nation, those are the five strategies. We'll be employing at least the first four pretty intensively across the state this summer, and we will ship those samples off to various labs. And we're sampling at a rate where we will have a very good likelihood of detecting this in wild birds if it actually comes to the state that way. In the meantime, what we're advising people now is that there's no reason to think that the disease is here. There's no reason not to continue to hunt and eat wild birds. We will be vigilant, and if we find a positive, then of course we in the sister agencies will have to respond and come out with different messages depending on the situation. But for the present, we're encouraging people to continue to use wild birds. But since wild birds, like any wild game animal, has the potential for carrying disease organisms, we advise, just as a matter of course, good hygiene practices. We think people should be using rubber gloves when they're dressing birds, cleaning the entrails out of birds, or gathering eggs for subsistence. People, when they're working on birds, should keep their hands away from their face. You shouldn't eat or smoke or drink while you're cleaning birds. You need to make sure that your knives and other tools and work surfaces are clean. And then finally, meat and eggs from birds should be cooked all the way through. And that destroys any of the disease organisms and keeps people safe. So at this time, we're, I think, successfully getting our arms around the challenge of going out and doing the sampling. The outreach challenge continues to be something that needs a lot of work. It's difficult, frankly, to talk about this as a bird disease and something that we need to be aware of, but not too worried about. At the same time, there's the potential for a pandemic among humans that needs to be prepared for. And so at the present time, we're trying to make the messages somewhat distinct, but obviously they're related, and people are becoming quite concerned, I know, in a lot of the villages about their subsistence take this springtime. So with that, I will yield to Dr. Gerlach and be happy to answer any questions after we're all done. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Bob Gerlach. I'm the state veterinarian. And you've heard Dr. Monsager and Matt Robus discuss avian influenza, give a background on it. And I guess from my perspective with avian influenza, we're looking at a coordinated and collaborative effort in dealing with this. And the effort involves our three agencies as well as the USDA for backup for me with respect to commercial birds and domestic birds. And the effort relates back to outreach, education, surveillance, and response. You've heard that avian influenza hasn't been found in Alaska or North America at all, and that there has been previous sampling. I mean, there have been over 12,000 birds that have been sampled since 98, and not only has the avian Asian H5N1 not been found, but no high pathogen avian influenza has been found in Alaska. There have been low pathogen viruses found, and the reason is that wild birds provide a reservoir for that virus to propagate and spread, and the low pathogen form causes very little disease in wild birds. But our concern is that that may be an avenue for avian influenza to be brought into the state, and the concern is that in Asia and Europe, we found that when people have been affected by this Asian H5N1, it has been through the contact with domestic birds, poultry. So what we've tried to focus on from the domestic end in the state is to educate people, to let them know how they can try to prevent the disease from becoming an issue with their birds. And we're looking at people who have commercial birds, and they're not a large industry in this state. We're looking at probably maybe about two dozen or fewer commercial operations. There are some that have upwards of 600 to 1,000 birds per operation. And these birds are not kept in the similar, or not kept similarly to operations in the lower 48, where they're totally confined and maintained within a building with very high degree of biosecurity. In most cases, these large operations in the lower 48, you have to scrub in and scrub out. You walk into a building, you disrobe, change or shower, change into protective equipment, then go in and interact with the birds so no disease is brought into those birds. So they're kept at a very high degree of security. That's not the case in most of the operations up in Alaska. And the other bigger concern are the backyard populations of birds that people have for their own personal production for meat or eggs. And it actually just for show, for exhibition and as pets. And then there's the third population of birds that are indoor pets. And you may think, well, indoor pets are not going to be exposed. They can be by anything that's brought into the home from outside. We've just, you know, heard the description that this virus is transmitted through secretions of the bird, so they can actually be from bird-to-bird contact. But the bigger concern would be the contact through the fecal excretion, and if someone walks or steps in something outside and then brings it into the home or has it on their hands and brings it into the home and handles their bird, then that bird can be exposed. So we try to go ahead and recommend to people to make certain preparations to be aware that the virus is there, try to go ahead and restrict your bird's access to wild bird populations outside by either making putting a fence up, trying to keep the feed and water separate from wild birds so you don't attract wild birds into the area. Don't bring the virus home. You want to be clean and when you access your birds at home. You don't want to have neighbors walking in and out. You want to restrict access, and if somebody has to go in to take care of the birds, you want to make sure that they do clean their shoes, clean their hands before they handle birds. And like I said, restricting access can be as easy as setting up a fence to keep wild birds out away. And that can be a big challenge for many people in the state. The state of Alaska is also developing the capacity to test for avian influenza in the Environmental Health Laboratory in Anchorage. We're working now to go through the proficiency testing to allow us to become certified to run the test in Anchorage. We anticipate that we could run anywhere from 1,000 samples that would be collected from backyard flocks. We last year collected at the state fairs when birds came in to congregation areas. This year we would be doing that same type of sampling there, as well as some backyard operations and the commercial operations around the state. That, in addition to sampling that would be done by the USDA Wildlife Services out around the airports and other areas such as that, we could look at testing upward of over 5,000 samples at the Environmental Health Laboratory. We will be setting up and trying to focus on the interaction when we have a backyard flock, that interaction with wild populations. So standing water outside or ponds or streams outside of commercial operations or backyard operations, we would be doing the same type of surveillance, testing feces, testing the water that's there in the environmental. I think the important thing is that we have a consistent message out to the public, let them know how they can be prepared. I think so far we've seen that Dr. Monsacher has presented that the state is getting prepared to handle one, the introduction of the possibility of just avian influenza, as well as preparing for a separate pandemic exposure, which would mean that there is a transmission of this virus between people. But I think we're getting prepared, and we are working together to go ahead and help coverage of different areas for surveillance, and I think we're pretty coordinated in what our response would be. And I just have just an example of the previous collaborative efforts that the Fish and Game has worked with our office in developing outreach education materials to people of the state. This is just a simple booklet for looking at diseases of wildlife that hunters would normally see. I think the authority that I have at the present time restricts my authority to poultry and to livestock. I think that the HB 380, that House bill that Dr. Monsacher did mention, is important to look at extending our authority so that we can deal with avian influenza in pet birds or in the possibility that the virus would get into other animals or other diseases that would be transmitted from pets or other animals to livestock. And that's all I have.
All right. Thank you. We'll now take questions from the committee and other senators. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Dr. Gerlach, if I could ask you a question first. When we look at the spread of this disease or this virus, what are the chances that other animals are going to be picking up the virus, things like domestic animals like dogs and cats or even foxes and things like that are going to be eating the birds that die out there and the eggs that are out there in this coming spring?
They have done work and research in that area. They know that domestic cats, as well as exotic cats or wild cats, have been affected, can be infected by the virus. Work in Germany has found that a stone marten has been affected. There have been experimental work that weasels, as well as a New Zealand white rabbit and rats have been infected. But those last three species have been associated with experiments in a controlled environment. We do know that pigs are also a susceptible species. So that would be a concern, and that would be one of the areas of making sure that we do surveillance both in wild and domestic animals to look for any abnormalities within presentation of animals for morbidity or mortality events.
Okay, and one of the comments you'd made, Dr. Gerlach, was the water and fecal spread. What is the chance this is going to infect the fish?
This virus, and I would even call on the experience of and knowledge of the colleagues, in most cases, avian influenza viruses affect warm-blooded animals and not fish. And so generally, they're very restricted to species, but we do know that these viruses can mutate and change, and that's how they jump from species to species. There had been a report in the lower 48 of a canine influenza, and that virus was associated, very closely related to a horse virus that affected some racing greyhounds on the East Coast and has been diagnosed throughout the lower 48. That virus is not related at all to this avian virus. And through all the testing and work that they've done in other countries, we have not seen other animals other than the cats and the stone marten had been affected by that virus.
Mr. Chairman, if I can continue. Dr. Monsager, you're talking about some kind of tracheal swab besides the cloaca that's going to be tested on this. It sounds like a pretty technically difficult thing to do.
Well, if I said that, I didn't mean to say that. respiratory samples, secretion samples, just like we do ordinary influenza testing for what kind of flu is around every year, is the specimen primarily that is used. If and when this, one of the reasons from the human side why it's important to us to understand the surveillance in animals that is going on is if this virus gets to the state, then our education of providers and to what to look for and the readiness to test human samples for H5 needs to be in place. We have the ability and the proficiency testing done at the virology lab in Fairbanks for the human side. So just like Dr. Gerlach talked about on the animal side, we can do the human samples. If the virus gets to North America, we can test in state up in Fairbanks.
Okay, are there parts of the birds that shouldn't be eaten for those people that are living on a subsistence type of lifestyle that,
from what I understand, as long as you cook it and the secretions are clear and they're not bloody, we've killed viruses and you're okay. So I think it's just a matter of cooking rather than parts of the bird to eat.
Why don't you click on the website over there where it talks about hunters. And
actually, let me go up here to hear the birds and animals. And down here at the page down, cooking birds and poultry.
Talking about, we're thinking mostly about wild birds now.
Yeah. And so here's one place you can go in terms of food safety and poultry products, and then hunter safety, I'll go to next. And basically, it's the same kind of stuff that Mr. Robus said. And then, if you go to hunter information, in here, do you know where it is, Matt? Maybe you should talk about it.
Mr. Chairman, the handout that's on the screen is also in, I believe, the package that you were handed, and it's our attempt to put common sense guidance for hunters on a page. It's a fairly dense two-pager, and so what we've done more recently is put together a little handout for distribution to villages so that people can get those same safety guidelines that we've been talking about here. If I could, I forgot earlier to mention something for the second presentation in a row, so I need to make up for it. We need people's help, and people need to know where they can go to talk about things they observe. So if they see sick or dead birds, what are they going to do? The Fish and Wildlife Service now is hosting an 800 line for Alaskan calls, a toll-free line for Alaskan calls. So again, we're partnering up so that if somebody sees a bunch of sick or dead birds, they can call 1-866-5-BRDFLU. So it's 1-866-5-BIRDFLU. And we'll take reports that way. And that's one of the ways that we'll get information so that we can mobilize teams of biologists and technicians to go out and do some sampling and run down the cause of that type of incident.
Very good. Matt, are there any, Dr. Monsager's map shows bird flu in Russia, any of it in the Russian Far East?
I'm not really well acquainted with the exact locations of the extent of the sampling in the Far East. I know that, you know, there's a well-publicized die-off of bar-headed geese in China. That's not all that close to the Bering Straits. But we do know, for instance, that large shorebirds are right now migrating up the west side or the eastern coast of Asia, headed for the western part, the Seward Peninsula and the YK Delta here in Alaska. And some of those birds are taken, hunted for subsistence. Again, there has really not been a documented case of a person getting this disease from a wild bird. There's one case in Azerbaijan that is being looked into that might be the first documented case. But this disease does not jump easily from wild birds to humans. However, the opportunity for it to get here through those shorebirds and a few of the goose populations is definitely there.
What are the birds that are in that exposed area that do come to the western, far northwest coast of Alaska?
Species like the curlews and godwits in the shorebird family, they're big enough to be taken for subsistence. Pacific black brant, which have a direct interchange between North America and Asia. The northern pintail is a dabbling duck we're all familiar with, but that species just goes all over the Arctic and hops between continents. And of course, then we have the potential problem of if the virus gets here and gets into our water bodies, then you have breeding ducks from the lower 48 who could carry it south, and we send waterfowl and other migratory birds to all the continental flyways across the U.S. So that's why this is a real linchpin of detecting the disease if it comes in through this end of the continent.
All right, we have some time constraints today, but I want committee members to be able to ask the questions. Senator Olin.
Just real quickly, and thanks, Mr. Chair. How long does it take to turn a sample around from your field work, Matt?
I'm not an expert at this, so my colleagues can straighten me out, but there's two steps here. There's a screening step and then a confirmation step. The screening can be done, I believe it's literally like a six-hour test. They call it a 24-hour test, so as soon as it gets to the lab, it can be out the next day. That gives you a presumptive positive for the general type of virus that it is, but to confirm that it's actually this strain of H5N1, it has to go to the USDA lab in Ames, Iowa, and that test takes maybe up to a week or so. So one of the issues the agencies are dealing with here is that until we know for sure that it's this strain of virus, we need to be measured in our response, but on the other hand, we don't want to just sit and pretend that nothing's happening if we have any inkling that the disease could be here. So we would probably move in that direction for doing more intensive sampling at the presumptive level. Once it's confirmed, then the agencies are going to have to move to a whole different level of response.
And just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I mean, if you get to the presumptive level, I mean, is the agency response then more intensive studying, or is there a public component on working with people from the region?
Well, in terms of managing wild birds, none of the agencies that have been involved with this think that we're going to halt the spread of the virus through culling, massive culling of wild populations of birds. Once we find it in wild birds, then the wildlife management part of this is trying to determine the prevalence and monitor it as it moves around the continent. On the public side, there's certainly going to have to be a response, and it's going to be us modifying our advice on how to use wild birds, possibly some regulatory action regarding hunts in certain places, and then there's the whole protection of the domestic bird and domestic animal end of things, and the human health concern, which Dr. Monsager could better on the
Through the chair, to say that there is intense discussion among the three of us and our agencies about this exact question would be, to put it mildly, is what are we going to do in response to a presumptive positive? First thing is, I think we are agreed that we want to make reasonably sure that that presumptive is probably true. Doesn't mean a second sample and so on, whether this is a human sample or a bird sample. But we need to start moving people, doing more samples. We need to be make sure we get the public messages ready. I can't believe if we get a presumptive positive yes, and we get a second presumptive positive yes the next day in another lab, that we don't need to be doing something with the public. We can't try and keep this a secret. We shouldn't for a week while we wait for confirmation. If you look in Europe, we go to say, what have the other countries in the world done in response to presumptive positives? They put it out and the media reports it, presumptively positive, waiting confirmation from London or Paris or Rome or wherever. I think we'll be doing something like that. But we got to be doing something with public messaging and so on. One of the things that was so important, I think, in the 1918 pandemic that was done wrong was governments lost the confidence of the people by not telling the truth. And the one thing we got to maintain is truth-telling with the public, I believe. What do you think?
It'll be a little bit different with the response for a presumed positive with respect to domestic poultry, because initially we would set up a quarantine and a hold order on stop movement of those animals from that premise, and then we would not do anything specifically to those birds with eradication until we had it confirmed. But there's a reporting for either whether it would be high pathogen H5N1 or the North American version, the low pathogen H5N1 strain that does circulate in North America. Either one of those two, any H5 or H7 avian influenza, would result in a quarantine and a hold order on those birds. If it was confirmed, then those birds would be depopulated. And then there would be further reporting from the state. At that point, we'd be reporting to the USDA, and then once that confirmation is done, it gets reported to the World Animal Health Organization, the OIE, in Paris, and then there's trade restrictions.
And Dr. Gerlach and I had an extensive conversation this morning. Without HB 380, he does not have authority in the non-domestic animal kingdom or world, right?
That's correct.
That's one of the reasons that's a priority. Senator Huggins.
Thanks, sir. You know, my family sort of religiously goes duck hunting on September the 1st every year, and I've sort of been thinking about that. And because you mentioned the 1918 flu epidemic, my hometown in Florida, you look at the headstones there, lots of them say 1918 to include my grandfather and one of my uncles. But anyway, that's the bad news. The good news, as I understand it, because I've been semi-preoccupied by this, reading everything I see because of what I just said, is that it appears to me that the people that have contacted, for the most part, the supermajority, are that have lifestyle, they live amongst the poultry. And I think that's the thing, that's the good news for us, and that, you know, the business of wild birds, ducks, whatever it may be, transmitting care in places is a very minor piece, though we have to be vigilant, and you're doing all the right things. But is my portrayal that kind of accurate?
I think that is a very good summary, and I think the European experience of the last 4 months confirms that. One, there have been a lot of wild birds scattered across many European countries positive, but there's almost been no domestic poultry involvement to date because there's better practices of how they take care of birds than there are in some of the less developed countries. And two, there's been no human spread at all in any of the European countries. And so I think this is one where we need to be careful, we need to be vigilant, we need to be prudent, but you should continue to plan on hunting on September 1st unless something happens between now and then.
My son will be happy with you.
All right. I'm sure there's going to be more questions as we go on. If you could, I think you ought to get those offline. And thank you. You got any more questions?
No.
Thank you. And I appreciate the diligence that you're going after, being prepared for what we all hope doesn't happen. All right. Who's going to talk to us from Department of Health and Human Services on personal care attendant program?
Good morning.
Okay.
Have a good time.
Please, identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Janet Clark, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services.
And?
And John Sherwood, Office of Program Review, Department of Health and Social Services.
All right. So in our last meeting, the subject came up of the PCA program and where it has gone, and we saw some figures that show that in our state, the program seems to have grown far more quickly than others, and the cost per client was seemed disproportionate. And so we are concerned, and three of us here, four of us sit on the Senate Finance Committee, and we're really concerned about the budget and the out years. So I guess a fundamental question is, do we have more people enrolled and being subsidized through the PCA program than we probably should?
Mr. Chairman, let me try to answer that in maybe a roundabout way. We have provided some updated information. I don't mean to confuse the committee, but when we heard you were interested in getting an update on PCA, we scrambled a little bit. We do not have any updated information from other states, which I understand the committee and Senator Wilken wanted to get, but the most recent data is 2002. So what we have provided is two spreadsheets. One basically updates the amount that we spend for Alaska, the smaller one. And what we've provided in the second row of information is expenditures for 2003, 2004, 2005, and projected for 2006, as well as recipients, so that you can get, so we can calculate an average expenditure per recipient to kind of show you where we are with the current information we have. And I think the committee, basically what you saw in the tripling of the average expenditure per recipient from 2001 to 2002 was the largest growth of the program based on the average expenditure per recipient. You can see that at this point there is a little more modest growth. It's not doubling or tripling since that time, since the average expenditure. So we thought that would be useful for the committee to see. The other updated information is that you had a chart in the letter that we sent on March 21st. We sent the committee a letter after the presentation on the personal care attendant regulations, giving you this information. And the chart that we had included, the legal size chart, it was yellow, was actually from a year ago. It was from March of 2005. So for the committee, what we have done is updated this chart only for Alaska. But what we wanted to show for the committee in the very first column is that for Alaska, the regulation changes what it would do for our program, so that you can see how we compare with other states. And Mr. Sherwood can talk a little bit more about the details of that, but previous to the regulations, the major changes was that, well, there are a lot of changes in the program, but for this chart comparison is that it used to be, before April 1st, that you to qualify, you only had to have one activity of daily living issue. Now you have to have two. So we basically said you have to have two issues with activities of daily living to qualify. And then for hours per week, any limitation, that's at the bottom of the chart. For Alaska's program starting April 1st, there will have to be a prior authorization for all hours of service. So I think other states, you can see they have hard caps or soft caps on that, and that's a regulation change. So we thought we'd at least provide that to the committee. so you could get a little more updated information on where we are, in addition to the other information we provided on March 21st. And before we get into a little more detail to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to talk a little bit about what we provided the committee on our historical numbers and our trends and our projections. I mean, to be perfectly frank, we have not done a great job in projecting this program. You know, we missed the mark in the early years when it was growing so fast. We didn't provide very good information about that tripling and that doubling of those years when more and more people were taking advantage of it.
Or have controls on who could.
Or have controls on who could. So the information that we provided in our March 21st memo, the charts that you know look like this, you know, I have to say we're very conservative because we're projecting the amount of savings. And so the numbers that we've been giving to the committee are at the most conservative as far as savings go. We're not trying to overpromise that the regulations will save, you know, an extensive amount. You know, we also have issues about as the regulations are implemented, everyone will be going through an assessment. If individuals are denied any level of service, they will have the right to a fair hearing and an appeal. And services continue until they exhaust those remedies. And so we've been very conservative on the uptake, you know, estimating how many people will drop off the program based on that experience as well. We also, I think as you all have heard, we're also fighting this issue with the growing senior population. The Lewin Group tells us that even if we drop people off the program, there are more seniors who are coming in who would qualify for this program. So I wanted to be sure to put that number in context. You know, I would be, you know, maybe the happiest person in our department if we're totally wrong and we see a significant savings. We could see much more than the $17 million that we basically estimated that we would see, be able to cut back. If we saw $25 million savings in this program, Mr. Chairman, I would be extremely happy, and I'm sure the legislature would as well. So we're really not trying to overpromise the amount of savings because dealing with this program has been difficult. So to answer your question, you know, I think in the past that one of the things that you see in the numbers is that with the audits we're doing from the Senate Bill 41 audits, the even discussing having the regulations have really, there's been a sentinel effect, as they say, on the program growth. And even without the regulations, we're seeing, you know, a decline or a flattening out, as you see, of personal care. So there's a whole bunch of things at work here. One of the things we want to caution is that and I think Mr. Sherwood can talk about this a little bit more. There is a relationship between those seniors who are on the older Alaskan waiver. We have a number of individuals who get personal care attendant services and are also on the older Alaskan waiver or other waivers. And so I know in other states they've developed their programs differently, but there is a relationship so that if we, you know, we want to make sure we don't harm anybody by the regulations, that people who need the service get the service, and that we need to, you know, to continue to monitor both programs to see that we don't see any increase as we decrease services in this area. We don't see increase on the other side. So at this point, and then I'll turn over to Mr. Sherwood, I think the department recommended in our March 21st memo that what we would do is we would provide interim reports to the legislature, to any committee, to all members of the legislature, if you're interested on, you know, on this whole issue, because it's hard for us to project since the regulations haven't even gone into effect yet. You know, we don't have the data that shows how many people are getting reduced service, what the expenditure pattern looks like. And so what we talked about is giving you a report on July 15th, September 30th. Frankly, we'll give it every month if you want. Based on this program, but that is our recommendation at this point, is to continue to do that.
All right, so we have some time constraints today. What I would prefer to do is let a couple of committee members here ask very specific questions some of which you won't be able to answer today, and we'll set up a time certain to, you know, come back and get those, but I want the committee members to be able to ask you the very specific questions. Senator Wilken?
Thank you, Janet. John, thanks for being here. Thanks for the timely response to the March 2nd request. I was glad to see that. And to be very brief, the thing, as I said the other day without repeating myself, the thing that scares me is that the data we have takes us to our chart 2002, takes us to there, and that's just when our new program kicked in. So if we think that we haven't even gotten to the expensive part yet, where we climbed 180% a year for 5 years, if we just forget that for the moment, what bothers me, when we look at this chart, Janet, this is the one that I believe we had the other day, and this deserves more discussion than we can do today, but if we looked at Alaska is spending $13,800 per person before our new program kicks in. So I looked at other states. I looked at Arizona. They offer much more than what we offer, and they're spending $3,300, plus or minus. I looked at some that Idaho is offering much more, vision, hearing, brain, HIV, dementia. They're offering a suite of projects of coverage in their state, and they're at $6,600. And we're at $13,000, almost $14,000. Montana, they offer about what we offer. They're at $8,000. Washington, close to us, about what we offer, $7,500. So the point being is that, you know, the numbers just don't square on what we're spending, and that is the question. Is our coverage seems to be about where other people are in our neck of the woods, and why does it cost us twice as much, at least twice as much, and that's before we get to the part where things really took off. I mean, I would believe, well, in fact, we've got 38,000 here, excuse me, 38 million, and the numbers you gave us today, that 38 million has grown, as we know, to almost 81 million. So if the per person expenditure increased at that rate, then we're going to, unless everybody else grew with us, which I doubt, we're going to walk away from, a runaway from the rest of the nation in what we happen to provide for PCA services. And I, for good or for bad, I just wonder if we're not going to become the PCA capital of America. And that bothers me, and I thought the regulations that we put in place, which I have, we're going to lower the slope, which they did, but it's just going to flatten it out. We're at the $100 million level in spite of new regulations, whereas the rest of America is significantly less by multiples. So that's the question that I guess I ask. Why don't these numbers square? And that's probably a subject not for today, but certainly for tomorrow.
Well, through the chair, Senator Wilken, I think there's a couple things in terms of caution about looking at personal care in isolation, because different states use different strategies. We use personal care. It's a, you know, in our jargon, it's a state plan service. It's available to everybody that needs it. In some states, they limit it to only offering it through their home and community-based waiver program. So you must meet an institutional level of care, and they and the only people that receive it may have access to other supportive services as well. And frankly, in a lot of states, they continue to rely much more heavily on nursing homes to provide this kind of care. Alaska has one of the lowest utilizations of nursing homes of any state. Although $20,000 a year sounds pretty expensive for personal care, it's nothing compared to the cost of nursing homes. It's not a one-for-one trade-off. I'm not going to claim it is. But I think when you look at those strategies, we've developed a strategy that's pretty heavily based on home and community-based care. And as a result, we see people of more intensive need being served through this program than many other states. Does that explain all of it? No, but I think that's an important component of it. And one, I think we're trying to understand better, and we think these regulations, by implementing a standard assessment that's going to be applied and performed by an independent contractor, are going to get us to the data to really understand that better. I think, as Janet said, we're a little nervous in terms of over-projecting savings because we know we're kind of sitting on top of this meter arc rise in the number of seniors in our population, and that's going to continue to put pressure on our long-term care spending in spite of all our best efforts. And of course, we all want to save money in personal care the right way, which is not to deny services to, you know, the frail, vulnerable population that needs it. And that's another reason for our caution and our desire to move carefully along this process.
Okay. Thank you, John.
As I remember a few years ago when this was being talked about in a previous administration, it seemed to me what was being said is that, you know, Alaskans are doing what they should, of taking care of their aging parents and their neighbors and relatives and friends and so on and so forth. But if some of those folks that are doing that, performing their human and relative, their duty to relatives, a few of them would do more, but they have their own financial constraints that can't keep them from doing it. So what we want to do is, for those folks, subsidize them a bit so they can continue to do what they are doing or want to do. My sense is that lots of people, some people who are out there doing it for their aging parents or their neighbor, somebody has said to them, hey, you're doing this really good neighbor thing. Do you know you can get paid for that? And I don't know how in the world you put a sort for that kind of stuff. You know, and Janet, you and I have been in and around discussions for years where we really want foster parents, but we don't want people doing it as a money-making proposition or a way of having a kind of a stay-at-home lifestyle that they always wanted to have. And you all's professional organizations or the trade magazines or anything, is there any discussion about on a national level of how in the world do we help those smaller group of people who need just a little boost in order to be able to afford to do that which their duty calls them to do, as opposed to those who are taking advantage of it?
Mr. Chair, I think there is some discussion about some pilot programs nationally. The federal government is promoting a program called Independence Plus, which has a lot of similarities to our consumer-directed personal care program. Most of the states that get into it find a way to put in some, if you want to participate in the program, you put in you sort of agree to upfront a certain kind of cap, and states calculate them differently. But basically, you agree to less total service, to have more flexibility in the way you can spend your money and more control over it. These require the use of waivers, which bring their own administrative overhead. Some states are pursuing those kinds of options. I think we've certainly looked at those things. First and foremost, though, we want to get control of the program we have right now before we start trying to throw another piece into the mix.
Any other questions, comments, things that we'd like to see the next time we have this conversation at this table? I would suggest, I don't mean to be at all threatening or stuff, but it may very well be that at some point we'll put a very real cap on the amount of money and say, come up with a triage, and you know, there's only going to be enough money for that group of folks that you all say are the ones that, you know, I don't know how to do it. I hope that you guys can get a handle on it. One of the things that this administration started out talking a lot about in the first few years was what they call quality control, and a whole lot of that had to do with weeding out fraud. And I'm not sure that that good start has continued, but I would encourage you all to look for folks that are fraud, you know, fraudulently getting the money, and have pictures of them up on the newspaper and website and hanging by their thumbs outside of your office or something. But, you know, get the message out that we're not interested in being taken advantage of. I'm sorry, I'm lecturing.
Mr. Chairman, just on the question of quality assurance and getting control of the program, Senate Bill 41 did a lot for the department as far as requiring audits, and we continue to do those, and those are an integral part of our whole program. We've established better communication in the department. We have an audit committee. We're setting up procedures and practices, working with the Department of Law as we proceed, developing sanctions. I can say that just in my experience, we are doing significantly more in that area than we have in the past, and we continue to promote that internally in our culture within Medicaid.
All right. Any further questions, comments? Senator Elton and then Wilkins.
I'm intrigued. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm intrigued by the comments about the expanding populations of elderly. I mean, figures I've seen say that portion of our population is growing at six times the rate as the younger population is. And it would help me, I guess, in a further discussion, if we had a better idea of what the demographic changes are that are coming that are going to hit us over the head. I mean, whatever we think about this program or nursing homes or anything else, I mean, there are huge implications for the state and how we provide services to that group of people. But it would also help me to get some perspective if you could kind of track for us kind of the history of nursing homes and the number of beds available, the communities that they may be available in, and how nursing home services may work here in Juneau. For example, we have some nursing home beds, but I suspect you don't have them in Puna, and how the interplay is in different regions of the state, so that when we talk about providing services, we can talk about how they're provided in both rural and urban Alaska. So that would be helpful for me in the next discussion.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, we did do a presentation in front of the Senate Finance Committee on the a Lewin Group study. We contracted with them, and we'd be happy to meet with you or your staff and go over the details of that study to kind of show you what the next 20 years might bring, which was our horizon. So we'd be happy to do that, as well as we do have the information on nursing home historical beds, and we can provide that.
Thank you.
And a subset of that, Dr. Munsager tells me that, yes, our population is growing older, people are living longer, but they're also living healthy and competent for a longer period of time. And he says that there's a paradigm shift, and on a generalized population data, we're no longer thinking of people 62 to 66 as being elderly and being out of the workforce and or needing help. That's shifted up, and he says it may be as much as a decade, you know, well into the 70s. So the justification for more service for seniors, I wouldn't think, is just lockstep with the progression in age, you know, but if you have any information on that, would be helpful. Thank you all. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you for recognizing the pre-elderly senator from Fairbanks. I was sitting here thinking, what next? And I guess what next is to remember that the presentation of a couple of years ago where this just sort of came upon us, and then Senator Green's good work last year to sort of get us to where we are today. this report, and then next year, whoever happens to be here, and the worst thing that would happen, Mr. Chairman, is that this committee, whoever happens to be on it, just lets this issue lie. And because we're really sort of a precursor to the Finance Committee, and we want to develop things through policy and not have to do it through the budget. But I guess I just, for the record, make note that this report for this year needs to be updated for next year, and we need to pay attention to this until we have some comfort that we're providing a program that's appropriate and affordable. And so with that, I thank you again for the time you've allowed us to have. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you. Maybe with the committee's approval, we'll gin up a letter for the committee to sign asking for that updated report for next year for whoever is sitting around here. All right. Thank you. Thank you all.